So if you've got a Bible with you, you might find it helpful. If not, there are some lying around the floor. I've just stolen one. And there's my Bible. Loads at the back of the room. My Bible is being charged up, so I'm moving on to this one. So we're going to look at the parable of the sower, as found in Matthew 13. And this is probably the primary teaching in the New Testament on mission. So this is Jesus kind of talking a lot about the process of mission, what it looks like and what it doesn't look like. And when I say it's probably the main teaching, why do I say that? It's because it's in Matthew, Mark, and Luke. It's not in John, because there are no parables in John. And it is a lot of verses. So Jesus has given a lot of space. The writers have given a lot of space. History has given a lot of space to this particular parable, particular story. So it has some real significance. So just to remind you, this will just help you as we look at about it. It's a parable about the seed. And it's a parable about the ground. And you've got the path, which it describes as hard. You've got the rocky. You've got the thorny. And you've got the good. So you've got four types of soil, and you've got one type of seed, and it's about what happens. So I'm going to read it to you, and I'm going to ask you a question to think about. And the question is this: what makes the good soil good, and what makes the bad soil bad? In other words, what is this parable about? And I'll give you a clue. It's got nothing to do with agriculture. So it's an agricultural parable. And in the second part of the parable, which I'm going to read to you, Jesus explains a non-agricultural answer to the problem. So that will help you. And you should get this because it's pretty straightforward. So we're reading from Matthew chapter Mark. Matthew 13 from verse 18, called Jesus Explains the Parable of the Sower. Listen then and learn what the parable of the sower means. Those who hear the message about the kingdom but do not understand it are the seeds that fell along the path. The evil one comes and snatches away what was sown in them. The seeds that fall on rocky ground stand for those who receive the message gladly, and as soon as they hear it, they receive the message gladly as soon as they hear it. But it does not sink deep into them, and they don't last long. So when trouble or persecution comes because of the message, they give up at once. The seeds that fell among the thorns and bushes stand for those who hear the message, but the worries about this life and the love for riches choke the message, and they don't bear fruit. And the seed sown in the good soil stand for those who hear the message and understand it. They bear fruit, some as much as 100, others 60, and others 30. So here we are. We've got this seed. God's truth, God's love, God's word. It's falling on these different grounds. So what is the key process here? What makes the bad soil bad? What makes the good soil good? You start with the bad soil, and the answer is kind of the same in a funny kind of way. So what makes the bad soil bad? Infertile. It's a good answer, but it's agricultural. So it's not an agricultural answer. Jesus is trying to explain it. So it's nothing to do with agriculture. What makes the bad soul bad, the good soul good? Nope. That, again, is kind of to do with agriculture. Nope.
Is it just that it is?
No, it's not just because it is. It's good thought, but it's not just because it is. It's right there. It tells you the answer. No. Nope. Say that to me again. It is to do with understanding. So those who the path understands nothing and the seed is just taken away. The rocky soil understands something because they received the word with great joy, but they don't understand the persecution. The thorny soil, which I think we have a lot of today, understands something and it begins to grow and it looks like it's good, but then the thorns grow up, which is the delight in riches and the love of the world. So this is hedonism, the pursuit of pleasure, the avoidance of pain, money. These things all grow up and they choke the word and it proves unfruitful. And lastly, you have got the good soil that seem to understand more or less what is going on, and they produce fruit. So let us think about this just a little bit more. So it tells us what the rocky soil didn't understand. It doesn't tell us what the rocky soil understood, because the rocky soil receives the word with great joy. So they must have understood something. So we'll have to speculate. So what do you think the rocky soil understood because they respond, yay, Jesus? So what did they understand? Yeah, loved by God, opportunity for new life, forgiveness of sins. Yeah, there's all sorts of things they could have understood. But there were obviously some fundamentals they did not understand. And therefore, they don't make it. And one of the things that I alluded to in the last session was that the church in the 80s and the 90s did not do a good job with preaching. Because much of the gospel that we preached was superficial. And I think that was awful. We preached a consumerist gospel. I even confess I did it a little bit. I listened to an old tape I preached many, many, many years ago, and I'm really unhappy that such a tape even exists, but it does. So you said things that you just think, really? Really? Why did I say that? And I think we were just caught up in that moment where the gospel was highly consumerized, and it just wasn't the real deal. And we created consumer Christianity. What is consumer Christianity? Consumer Christianity is when you come to church for a blessing. And if you're not kind of blessed enough, the worship isn't kind of dynamic enough, you go somewhere else. And if you go somewhere else and you're kind of not blessed enough, you go somewhere else. And when you've gone somewhere else about three times, what do you then do? You don't bother. And we have, over this last 20 years, lost tens of thousands of young believers to disillusionment and disappointment with the church. And so we have to ask ourselves the question, whose fault? Whose fault is it that we have a generation of disappointed and disillusioned Christians out there? Their fault? Or my fault? The institution's fault or their fault? And I think it's the institution. The institution got it wrong. It made mistakes. In its enthusiasm to articulate this kind of charismatic moment that had happened, in its enthusiasm for this new awareness of Jesus, it did not engage brain. It did not think profoundly or long enough or hard enough, and it articulated something that was not quite right. And there are times, I think, when church leaders need to have what I call an oops moment. You've watched the film Independence, I'm sure, and there is this wonderful oops moment, and it goes oops, and we've had an oops moment. And when you have an oops moment, you need to put your hand out and say, hey, we got it wrong, and we'll just be honest about it and say we got it wrong and now we want to rectify it. So I think there's been a lot of rethinking about what is the gospel. And I'm going to talk about that in a minute. Yeah, what is it we're actually articulating as this good news? Because it's not what we did articulate. And I actually think we have a struggle on our hands right now. And that's why doing the word is harder than doing the deed. It's easier to reach out in good works because it's clear. But to preach the gospel has got very, very complex because we've actually kind of lost language and metaphor and meaning. We're not quite sure what we're preaching. So it's a struggle. And that's what we see here in the rocky ground. So it's time for churches to put an oops moment. But not only did we create consumer church, we created consumer God, where we gave people certain expectations that God would do certain things. So kind of God has to jump through the loop of our expectations. And the only trouble is, this kind of isn't in the Bible either, that when you look into the Bible, it's we go through his expectations, not us through our, not him through our expectations. He's the boss, not us. So we serve him, not us serve him. So we've created this kind of sense where we've created this sense where people have got angry. They feel because God did not do these things. But probably we should never have given them the expectation that God would do those things. So again, our fault, and we've created a problem. So we see that part of the problem is of the rocky soil is consumerism. Here. But the thorny soil is another problem. The thorny soil is people who receive the word and they grow up and they look like the real deal and they look fabulous. And yet somehow the weeds come up and choke the word. Here's a frightening statistic. Every year, all over this country, we send young people to universities from churches. In 4 years' time, after they've gone through those universities, what percentage of those young people will continue on with church? So how many will we lose? So these are young people who've gone to church, gone to university with a measure of faith. What happens after university? And I'm not going to sort of talk about their faith because I don't actually know about that, but I can talk about their church attendance. What's going to happen to that church attendance, to a large number of them? We're going to lose them. How big a percentage do you think it is?
60.
It's like 30%. So it's somewhere between 60 and 70% that we're going to lose to church attendance. Now, have we lost them to faith? I haven't a clue. I think we've lost some to faith, and some probably not. But we've certainly lost them to church, which tells us something about church that's quite frightening. But it also tells us something about what is going on there. Now, I'll give you a Lawrence idea. Now, I'm going to be a little bit controversial, so I just need to do a little something. If you want to know about the truth, this is the truth, this is a good thing. When you hear preachers preach, however, I'm not preaching the word of the Lord, am I? What am I preaching? Aha, an opinion. And because it's an opinion, here's some good news. What's the good news? Yeah, you don't have to believe what I believe. The good news is you don't have to believe anything I say here today. You can look at what I say and go, where did they get that man? Goodness gracious me. Yeah, where in the world did he come from? You really don't have to believe that. So I want you, your adults, to think things through. And if you like what I said and you agree with most of it, I shall be really happy. But actually, I'm equally happy if you've thought about it and you think, no, that's not for me. I'm quite happy about that, as long as you're thinking. And the reason I say this is it gives me permission then to go a little bit to the edge. So it gives me opportunity to push the boundaries a bit. So help us think. Also, I'm quite enthusiastic about some of these things, but just because I'm enthusiastic doesn't mean they're right. It just means Lawrence likes them. So there we go. So what happens, I think, is this. that when a lot of young people grow up in church, they get a great deal of Christian experience. And they assume a worldview. And I think the worldview they often assume is quite secular. And I take this from an American psychologist, sociologist called Judith Harris. And Judith Harris is a unique sociologist in as much as she believes people are shaped by their genetics and their peer groups, not their genetics and their background. So most sociologists think you're shaped by your genetics and your background. But she's a bit more specific. She says it's your peer group that shapes you. So her view would be that these Christian young people are shaped by their unchurched friends, largely speaking, but they have a great deal of Christian experience. And then when they go to university, they hit a tsunami, an absolute tsunami of other experiences and other views. And this foundation is just not strong enough. Christian experience without a Christian worldview is not strong enough. And they will go over. They will get swamped. They will get disillusioned with God. They will get disappointed with church. They will think churches, and all sorts of good things will happen, but in the end, it creates some problems. So again, whose fault's this? Well, it's probably our fault. It's church's fault that we've been great on experience, but poor on worldview. That we haven't really equipped young people in their heads for life. So I asked church leaders to think about this. What 10 things do you think every young person should know before they go to university? About God, church, life, sex, sexuality, etc. and etc. What do you think they ought to know? Think of those 10 things and then make sure that in partnership with their parents and the youth leaders and the church that we teach those things. Now, they won't be causative. They won't make that young person believe, but it might just give them a better chance. And one of those things is to discuss church in a much more honest way, to say that church is a flawed institution. You know, it has good in it and it's bad in it, and some bits of it work really well and some bits of it are a bit awkward. Some bits we're doing a great job, some bits we're doing a poor job. We just got to kind of have a much more realistic view. I love church. I'm very passionate about church. I'm very passionate about local church. I think it's perfect? No, I do not. Do I think we've got it all right? No, I do not. But I'd rather be in it than out of it, you see what I mean? I'd rather kind of be in and transform than be out and not a part. But I recognize in some areas we've done a great job, some areas we've done a poor job. And that needs to be part of our worldview. We need to have a worldview that says, is God just? And if he is, why all these questions? Why all this pain? We need to equip people for the answers. We need to equip them for what happens at university. My son's a very good-looking boy. And he rang me up one day at university and he said, Dad, I've got a bit of a problem. I said, what's that, son? He said, it's a very attractive girl in my bedroom. I said, and? And she's taking most of her clothes off and is sort of offering me some fun. What do I do now? So I said, well, that's a good question, Justin. Why don't we just have a long conversation on the telephone? And maybe in 30, 40 minutes she'll have gone. Jeepers creepers, that never happened to me. Well, I didn't go to university, so it wasn't going to happen to me. But, you know, it's just a different world. It's a different world. Have we prepared young people for this world so that they actually know what they may or may not do? Another friend of mine, Jono, he was a good-looking boy too, and Jono sharing his house with his non-Christian mates, goes back late at night, and there's a kind of strange girl in the house who's a kind of mate of a mate of a mate or something. Anyway, Jono chats with her, and about 2 o'clock in the morning, Jono goes off to bed. About 3 o'clock in the morning, there's a little knock on Jono's door, and this girl comes in, and she says to Jono, I'm bored. And she opens up her coat, she's absolutely stark naked, and she's absolutely beautiful. And poor old Jono, it's 3 o'clock in the morning and he's a young man and he's, you know, he's going, oh my God. And she says to Jono, you want to have some fun? Now, Jono, good lad, Jono, he said, he thought about this for a while, and he said to this girl, he said, well, the answer to this is yes and no. He said, you are very beautiful. But my best friend wouldn't think this is a good idea. And she said, your best friend isn't in this room, mate. And he said, no, my best friend is in this room. And then she turned to him and she said, you're one of these Christian boys, aren't you? And he said, yeah, I'm a Christian boy. She said, that's such a shame because you're a beautiful boy. And off she went. So, yeah, it's a challenge, isn't it? But then there are all sorts of other challenges we talk about. Money. Our view on life. A lot of young people, too, when they step into their first job, they have not been prepared for what it means to work. What that is going to be like. And that peer group gets a hold of them and pulls them out. So these are real challenges that I think we've not done well. And again, I don't think it is about blaming these young people. I think it's about taking responsibility that we've allowed the thorns to grow up and we haven't explained them to young people. So that when those thorns turn up, young people are equipped and they can make their own choices. And we're going to lose some, win some. And that's fair enough. That's going to be the way it is. But at least we've given them an opportunity to kind of engage brain. Do not be conformed to this world, but be transformed by the renewing of your mind, that you may prove what is the will of God, what's good, acceptable, and perfect. So we need a good blend of experience and content. So I'm all for Christian experience, but Christian experience without telling people the why behind it is not helpful. So I was involved in this organization called YWAM, and still am to some degree another, but not as much as I were. And I used to say to young people, if a teacher comes in and tells you to do something, they give you a rule, put your hand up and say why. And if they say, because the Bible tells them to say, that's not an answer. Tell me why. Now, I wasn't very popular by doing this, but it was good for the young people because it makes those teachers try to explain their worldview and their values, and they shouldn't ask the young people to do anything unless they can do that. So these young people can earth the Christian rule in principle, and then it makes sense, and then you can do it. But the rule without the principle is kind of, that's just going to disillusion you and disappoint you. You've got to have both together. So what we want is kind of experience and content together. So what Jesus is saying here is there's quite a bit to understand. And so Christianity is something that is experienced and understood. But it's kind of following. So it's kind of got to be seen in a pathway. It's got to be seen as a journey. That it's not a kind of Eastern moment of understanding, but you might have an instant moment of honesty. In Luke, it talks about this parable, and it says the good soil had an honest heart. So you could say that understanding over honesty are the kind of ingredients of conversion. So it's these two things that have got to kind of live in a parable together. Now, honesty can be an experience. So you can go somewhere and think, wow, but you don't understand. And I think it's been a challenge sometimes. I'm one of the very few evangelists that's taught people how not to lead people to Christ. And that's why I love things like Alpha and processes. Because some people are not ready to come to faith because they don't understand. So if somebody comes up to me and says, Lawrence, can I become a believer? I'll say, what do you think it means to be a believer? And unless I kind of think they can answer that question, then I might say to them, hey, why don't we meet and chat again? And chat again. And chat again. And particularly if we're in a culture where 40% of people think that Jesus is fiction, what that tells us is that this is There's a lot in this story they don't know. And therefore, we've got to kind of be able to help people understand the story. So that there's a journey to faith, isn't there? And that's a scale of 1 to 10. And people are on the journey. I live near Bedford, and of course in Bedford we have John Bunyan, and then John Bunyan we have Pilgrim's Progress. And Pilgrim's Progress is this fantastic book about the journey, about the story. And John Bunyan understood that you had to go on this journey. You had to travel. You had to think these things through. So here we are. That is the kind of process that we're going on with people. And we're helping them on a journey. And you could, in kind of superficial terms, break this journey down into three parts, if you like. You could say that the first part is what I call sowing one. This is about understanding that God is good and Christians are okay. And that would appear to be happening out there. The second part of the journey, this is the hardest bit, is the content of the gospel. What does it mean to be a Christian? What does it mean to have a different worldview? And the last part is the response. And then there's the whole process of discipleship and keeping, etc., etc. So we're helping people on this journey. We're helping them to go along the journey. And it would appear that we've done some good things in helping people go along this journey. But we need to do a lot more. And I think what we're facing in the culture at this time, which we're going to look at in a minute, is this middle box here. We're good with connecting with people. And through Alpha and so many other things, we're good at giving people an opportunity to respond. But I think what we're not so good at is describing what it means to be a Christian. We've kind of got a bit stuck here. And it's time for a rethink. And I would be very clever if I had the answer. So when we look at this, I'm just going to kind of raise questions more than give answers. But I've got a few hints. But we need to have a look at it. But before we sort of go there and we think, oh no, okay, no, we will go there. And we'll take up that point later. So we are thinking about this kind of journey that people are going on. And we're thinking about this content of the gospel. And what it might be. And just by an academic exercise, just for a bit of fun, you could probably break the gospel into four boxes. You could say that the gospel is some good news. It's about an overwhelming problem. That means the good news is not available. It's about an amazing answer that makes the good news available. And it's about a life lived out. We're going to live this thing out. So those are four boxes. And I want us to think about the gospel in the context of those four boxes. But then I'm going to kind of do something a bit strange. I'm going to say that's a way of looking at it. And then I'm going to give you a totally different way of looking at it, which is looking at the Jesus paradigm. So I'm going to give you two totally different ways to think about this, but this is still quite a good thing to do. So if the gospel is good news, I got 200 church leaders together a couple of good years ago, and I said, tell me the good news of the gospel without using religious language. And I want to tell you, this was a really disappointing experience. They found it extremely difficult to articulate good news. So let's just do a bit of Billy Graham for a moment. In 1954, Billy Graham preached in London. He preached in very religious language, well, relatively religious language, and his kind of main connect point was forgiveness. And loads of people responded. So why did that work? Why did his language work, and why was forgiveness a good idea as a connect point? And you've got to think 1954. So why did they... Let's do language first. Why did they understand the language? It's a relatively easy question.
Everyone
They're brought up in church and Sunday school is the answer. That they had grown up in Sunday school. They had much more church involvement. Therefore, the language was familiar. Why did forgiveness work? Post-war, and everybody is one. Okay, so let's have a look at it another way. That's sort of the answer. What was the plumb line of right and wrong in the 40s and the 30s? Not that everybody lived it, but the universal plumb line, the moral plumb line was what? Where did it come from? It came from the church. So if you go back to the Great Awakening, that by 1850, 70% of the population is going to church, 50% of them are evangelical Christians. If you go back to the start of the Sunday school movement, in 1800, 120 children went to Sunday school. By 1825, how many children went to Sunday school? Just 24 years later. Answer, 1.25 million. By 1890, 70% of all children went to Sunday school. What did those children learn at Sunday school?
God and the King.
Yeah. They learned a Christian kind of moral plumb line, and they learned their Bibles, and they learned to read and write through their Bibles. So in this country was a kind of Christian morality that was held by about 70% of the population. So imagine a seesaw. You've got a secular government sitting on a Christian moral framework, and you've kind of got more than 50% down here, and you've got 30% up here that are into everything else, sex, drugs, rock and roll, whatever they want. So they are always there. But if you think of your grandparents and your great-grandparents, they would have had a Christian moral framework. Certainly mine would have done. Some of your grandparents might not have done because they're a lot younger. But anyway, so they had a Christian moral framework. Therefore, their consciences were alive. And during the war, people were naughty, to some degree or other. You know, it's the war. And I know this because I've read my mother's diaries. And what's more, she's still alive. She's 95. And she was a very good moral girl who was a little naughty during the war. Now, it's not hard to know that she was a little bit naughty during the war, because if you can count, you can look at my eldest brother's age and count, and it doesn't add up. So I think a lot of people like that would have had a conscience. They would have felt bad about that. And what did Billy Graham preach? He preached forgiveness. And that was the message they needed to hear. And so thousands of people responded to Billy Graham because the connect point and the language were good. I hear people preaching today who preach in very similar language to Billy Graham, which is kind of a waste of time. But they also preach forgiveness as their major connect point. But we are in a different culture. In today's culture, nothing is wrong, everything is right. The only thing that is wrong is to say that you're right. There's very little that is wrong today. So consciences are much lowered, and therefore preaching forgiveness is probably not the good news you want to preach. Now, it's not to say that forgiveness is not a part of the Christian message. It's just to say it's not my first step forward. So I have done all of that to give you a kind of thought. Is what do you think is the good news then? So if it's not forgiveness, what is the good news of the gospel? Love? Could be. Could be. Salvation is a good word, but it's a very religious word. So it doesn't really help us because it doesn't really say anything to someone else. Maybe. I think there are more exciting ideas than these, by the way. These are good, but we can get more exciting. Yeah, kind of like that. I think values have a really interesting place. I think they're really hard to articulate, but I have a real sympathy to a value-based approach to preaching the gospel. Let me give you another clue. You have internal and external things. And historically, when we've looked at Jesus' message, we've looked at internal things. But Jesus said, I've come to set the captives free, make the blind see, bring truth and justice. So Jesus talked about external things and internal things. I think when we preach the gospel, we almost exclusively preach it in internal things. But maybe it's time for us to grapple with some of these external things. What does justice look like? What would a better society look like? What would some of these external things look like? And could we preach the gospel through those? To say Jesus has come to change the order of things a little bit.
But then why would you want to get involved with, like, what value does that have for you individually? How do you respond to that?
Well, you respond because you see an opportunity to live for something bigger than yourself. So you respond not for the personal benefit, but for the corporate benefit. And I think a lot of people would argue that today's generation are more motivated by a corporate benefit than a personal benefit. So actually, my generation, the consumer generation, were more motivated by a personal benefit than a corporate benefit. And that's why we ended up where we were with a consumer gospel, because we were very motivated by what we could get. Your generation is not so motivated by what you can get. You're more motivated about that big picture out there. So my generation didn't think big picture. Your generation does. We should have thought big picture, justice, and la, 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 but we didn't really. And that's why our generation is seen as a generation, the hippie generation, that kind of betrayed your generation, because we kind of looked like we would do something about the status quo, and then we did very little about it. We just enjoyed it. So I think it's a challenge. So we could think of the gospel in external language, and I think it is really hard to do. But it would be really great if we could, because justice and truth and a new way of living is going to be more and more of an issue. And we need to think how we can articulate it. But we can also think of some of these internal things. So my daughter, who's a preacher, she says, you matter to young people. And I think that's kind of good news. I often talk about friendship. You know, people are looking for friendship. And I talk about Jesus, who is can be their friend. The Bishop of Chelmsford talks about be yourself, be your real self, be the self that God's created you to be, not the self who your friends want you to be or other people want you to be. So we need to kind of find ways to articulate good news. It's got to be exciting. It's got to be something worth giving your life for. It's got to be out there. We don't have a lot of time on this, so it's quite superficial. The second thing we have to describe is an overwhelming problem. In the old days, this is called sin. An overwhelming problem takes away the possibility of the good news. So we've got to be able to describe the overwhelming problem. So if you can't use sin to describe the overwhelming problem, how would you describe it? Damage. Yep, it's damage.
Selfishness.
Now, I like selfishness. And I'll give selfishness just a little bit of theological kind of rooting. In the Garden of Eden are two trees. The tree of the knowledge of good and evil and the tree of life. What do these two trees symbolize? They're symbols of something. What are they symbols of? I think they're symbols of kind of where you're going to place your worldview. Are you going to have the tree of life, which is God at the center, and you work your worldview through God's worldview? So he's at the center. Or are you going to have the knowledge of good and evil, where you choose what's right and wrong, so you put mankind at the center? So the problem with the tree of the knowledge of good and evil is it's a principle of self-rule. It's humankind ruling. Very frightening. And the fruit of the principle of self-rule is selfishness. And selfishness is a universal problem. You know, governments do it, people do it. So it kind of works. So how many of you have been hurt by someone else's selfishness? Answer, everybody. But the other part of that is how many of you have been selfish and hurt someone else? Answer, everybody. So it's a kind of universal problem. So when I'm out there talking to people and I say to them, selfishness is a problem, I've never had anybody say, no, it's not. So selfishness is a good way to describe the overwhelming problem. But you can also describe the overwhelming problem kind of locally. You can describe it politically. You can describe it in lots of ways. So locally, I could describe it like this. I live in a town called Harpenden. It's officially the second or third wealthiest town in England. But Harpenden has a secret, has a really horrible secret. What is the shame of the little town called Harpenden? What's its secret?
It's got what?
It's got a YWAM base. No? It has got a YWAM base, which I helped put there, but you know, it has.
Is there like an undercurrent of poverty in the town?
No, not a single soul. Well, there might be, but there's not a lot. It's a very wealthy town. I'll tell you what the secret is. More young men have walked into the woods and hung themselves for no reason, without suicide notes, than any other town in England. For no apparent reason. Without notes. St. Albans and Harpenden. 2 years ago, three boys in St. Albans walked into the woods and hung themselves. And nobody knows why. That just tells us something of the pain, something of the problem, something in society. So these kids had everything. They're all middle class kids. They all come from wealthy families. And all of them kill themselves. So it just makes no sense at all. It just tells us we've got a problem, isn't it? There's something not right out there in our society. And you know, we'd love it to be right. We don't want to see these things happen. We have an amazing answer. What's the amazing answer? 2 Corinthians chapter 5. Every now and again you find a passage of scripture that just kind of you go, really? You've got to be kidding me. And 2 Corinthians chapter 5 and verse 15 is my favorite verse in the New Testament. Because the Apostle Paul is in Corinth. And Corinth is a bit of a nightmare. They're sleeping with their mothers. The church is a mess. And there's all sorts of hanky-panky going on. And, you know, he's just really troubled about it. And he's trying to articulate the gospel. And he comes up with this fantastic little verse. 2 Corinthians 5 and verse 15. I'm looking at this in the Good News Bible. He died for all, so that those who live should no longer live for themselves, but only for him who died and was raised for their sake. So Christ died for all, which is the kind of old message. We know that. But here's the radical twist, that those who live may no longer live for themselves. So it has been said that this postmodern generation is the most live-for-yourself generation the world's ever seen. Now, I'm not sure that's really fair, but that's what some people have said. I think it's probably more true of my generation, if the answer be really honest about it. But anyway, so the human condition is that we live for ourselves. And the answer of the gospel is we live for something bigger than ourselves. We live for ours, for him who for our sake died and was raised. So being a Christian is about repositioning your center. It's not about experiencing forgiveness. It's about repositioning. It is saying that Lawrence no longer lives for Lawrence, but for something bigger. Now, it's not saying that Lawrence will not live for Lawrence sometimes. Sadly, I do. We all do, don't we? That's called selfishness. And I have to say sorry. But in general terms, I have decided to live for something bigger than myself and trying most of my time to live that way. So Christianity is about living for something bigger. It's about surrender. So one of the things, and rather than talk about being saved and salvation, I'd rather talk about surrender. C.S. Lewis, a great kind of thinker, used the word surrender as his word to describe faith. That he writes this little bit in Surprised by Joy. He had written this kind of essay on atheism. And he realized the essay was perfect. And that he had proved without shadow of doubt that God did not exist. And he put the final stop on his essay, and that's it. Boom. God, you're toast. And then he says, Jesus walked into the room and I surrendered. It's amazing. So he's proved that God doesn't exist. And in some way or other, Jesus walks into the room. He doesn't tell us in what way Jesus walked into the room. We're presuming that this wasn't physical, but something happened to C.S. Lewis. He had a God experience at that moment and he surrendered. I love that. Love it, love it, love it. So this is about surrendering. This is about who's in control. And I think it's often possible for people to have a lot of Christian experiences, but they've never really surrendered. They're still in control. Because I think God knocks a lot. But we still got to surrender. We still got to give in. I think we can experience Christian things and never really have given in. It's possible. So, and then we need to explain the life lived out. And that's kind of complex too, that we need to talk about what it means to have a Christian worldview. We need to have a little look at the Sermon on the Mount. What does it mean to be a peacemaker? What does it mean to do some of these things? You know, what is it, the life lived out, going to look like? So that's a way of thinking about it. It's kind of helpful. But there might be an even more radical way of thinking about it, which is to actually think about Jesus. And I think a lot of people are beginning to kind of understood that if we live in a society where 40% of people know nothing about Jesus, then what we ought to be talking about is Jesus. That we should be describing Jesus a lot more than we are. What he said, what he did, who he was, what was he like? There's a very famous bishop, ex-bishop in England, Tom Wright. And Tom Wright, when he was the chaplain of Oxford College, he said one of the good things about being chaplain is he had to greet every student with the dean of the college when they came in. And he said most of the students would come up to him and say, "Hi, chaplain, this is the only time that we'll shake your hand. We'll never see you again because we're not Christians." And he used to say to them, "Well, neither am I." And they go, "Beg your pardon, you're the chaplain." "Oh, I'm not a Christian." I say, "Really? Why are you?" He said, "I'm a follower of Jesus. I follow Jesus the Nazarene." Now, he's being a little bit semantics and he's being a little bit, you know, but he's engaging them with a thought. He's trying to say, for me, this is about this man called Jesus. And Tom Wright has continued to put a Jesus apology forward. He's just written a new book about it. And there are a lot of people beginning to say that we need to articulate Jesus. What did he stand for? What was he like? What did he say? And let Jesus speak for himself. Now, how can we do this in a practical way? Well, I think in a practical way, we can think about the Bible verses that we really love. And that when people talk to us about Christianity, we could do it through those verses. So, Lawrence, what do you think about church or Christianity? You can say, well, Jesus said this. And then kind of describe it through Jesus. Now, this isn't easy either. But maybe it's just a practice. We've got to learn some new ways of doing things. And this afternoon, I'll give you some more ways of doing this. But we're beginning to think of how we can bring Jesus center stage. So I've been involved in a couple of projects. I'm involved in a project right now where we have just written a new booklet about Jesus, talking about his history, what he said, what he did, just to give a little bit of historicity, a little bit of background to him, and just to give it to people who come to church. And it's high quality, and it's four color, and it just gives a little bit more of a picture of who is Jesus. And so we're kind of trying to answer some of these questions, thinking through where we're going on this kind of journey. So we want to talk about Jesus, and I explain this a bit more in here. So in this book, you get more of the kind of overview. In this book, I look much more at the gospel and questions. I look at language. I give a whole bunch of words. You could translate them, but maybe we're trying to find new metaphors. So any questions out of what I've been sharing so far? Has this been helpful?
Yes.
Questions? That's a really good question. So, in a sense, we're trying to educate everybody. Yes, so we're trying to educate you, but at the same time, I'm engaging church leaders, and we're engaging on a wider basis, church leaders, to say, look, this language change. And you, with language, you've got two things. You've got change of language and explanation. So, I don't mind if people have the old language and they explain. So I went to a high Catholic church service the other day, Anglican. It was amazing. But unless you understood the code, you did not know what was going on. So I said to the clergyman afterwards, really godly man, I said, I loved your service, but there were loads of people in this room today who were somewhat confused. So I don't think you should change your service, but I do think you should explain why the bell. Why the incense? Because you've got good reasons for all of that. Well, just tell people what they are. Because they haven't got a clue. So you rang a bell and they all kind of wondered if it was tea time. You know, they had no idea what was going on. You did a whole bunch of incense and they loved the smell, but they had no idea what that was all about. So I think it's about explanation and change. And a lot of churches are grappling with this. So the sort of churches you're going to be involved in, I think, probably are grappling and are changing. And the sort of people who are doing evangelism, to be honest, are grappling and changing. There are some churches who aren't changing, but they're probably not reaching out. So, other questions? Thoughts?
Oh,
I think it has a great deal to do with it. And I think there are, the church is caught and always will be caught between a rock and a hard place. And that rock and that hard place is the values of the world and the values of the church. And we will always be caught in this challenge, and we will always not go to where they want us to go. But there are some issues that are slightly different that we should have changed if we didn't. So, for example, you know, the church should have been at the forefront of the green issue, and we weren't. We should have been at the forefront of women's equality, and we weren't. But we have been the forefront of a number of other things. So the change of business practice in the 18th and 19th century, the fact you have a garden, there are all sorts of things the church has been involved in that have brought huge changes. And some things that they haven't. And then there are some issues where the church is going to fundamentally differ because of its overall theology. and the gay issue is going to catch the church right there. So you have 2,000 years of church history that say one thing, and you have other people saying, "Now we need to do this." And the church will find this very difficult. And as Justin Welby has said, you know, can he change church history in half an hour? Does he have the right to do that? You know, if the church has had a view for 2,000 years, does he have the right to change it in half an hour? He's not convinced he does. Therefore, the process will be slow. So I think some of these things are complex. So some of them are external issues, and some of them are things the church can do something about. Some of them, well, we're just going to have to live with them for the time being, because we're still kind of working out what we think. So they're tricky. Other thoughts? So was this helpful?
Yes.
Think about this a little bit. So what we're going to do this afternoon is be a little bit more practical. So we're going to put this in the life of your local church. So we're going to think of a rhythm of mission. We're going to think about conversational tenors, how you have conversations with people. And we're going to make this very practical. So hopefully you can see how more people can come to faith in the context that you work in.